Okay, we are going to get started.
Wow. This is very cool. I'm Jessica. I'm codependent. I'm so glad to see all of you here. Thank you for coming. Good evening and welcome to this glorious Ken and Mary event. I am the meeting leader tonight, so I'm going to be introducing Ken and Mary. They were gracious enough to agree to come tonight. I'm very grateful that they're here. And Mary's going to be the first speaker, but I'm going to do like a general introduction for both of them. Okay? So Ken and Mary have over 35 years of codependent recovery. Ken has 43 years of addiction recovery, and Mary has 37 years of addiction recovery. They met originally in Alcoholics Anonymous. They've been married for 36 years. They have four children-in-law. They have 7 grandchildren. They started CODA on October 22, 1986, at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Phoenix, Arizona, and they wrote the CODA Big Book, a blue book, in the mid-90s. And they currently live in Cave Creek, Arizona. So we are so blessed to have so much recovery tonight, and I would like to just welcome now Mary.
My name is Mary, and I'm a very grateful recovering codependent, and I'm so glad to be here. Thank you. So when we were talking with Jessica about coming over, she had emailed and invited us, and we were excited about doing that. We had come to do these previously, and they were always so much fun. And but she had asked, I said, okay, what would you, anything particular you would like us to talk about? And she said, how about maintenance? What do you do once you've gone through the steps and then life happens? You know, how do you handle that? What do you do? And so I was just going to share, because definitely I've had a life happen in the past 35 years, but just to be able to share about that and some of the things that have happened and some of the tools that I've used throughout that. The first, what I would say, is I have worked the steps so many times. I believe that our answers come through the steps. There's such amazing wisdom. I found that when I first joined Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time going through my steps. And I had never read anything like that before. You know, it was a way that I could believe whatever I wanted to believe. I could go through and deal with the areas I was powerless over and how my life had gotten unmanageable without any shame. And I don't know about you, but when I got to CODA, even after doing the steps in AA, when I got to CODA, I was still filled with a tremendous amount of toxic shame. And that shame told me I wasn't good enough, I wasn't smart enough, I could go through all sorts of messages that I had learned about myself through the abuse and the trauma that I experienced during my childhood. And that those messages had stayed with me my whole life was just tremendous. I had reacted to those messages. I'd tried to manipulate those messages. I'd tried to be a chameleon, so none of you would see that. It felt like this big glaring ball that was sort of in my solar plexus, you know, that none of you would see that. If I could just say it right, do it right, look right, all that kind of bullshit, excuse me. I don't know how else to put that, because it was just all these ways that I just manipulated myself over and over and over again and conned myself. And, you know, what CODA brought for me was a way to untangle all that and start to unweave it. It took me a number of times through the steps for myself in CODA before I really felt like I was landing in this body. I came from a lot of abuse from my background, sexual abuse and physical abuse and emotional abuse, plus abandonment, neglect, and it just, I hadn't realized, but it had just done a number on me. And my way, I started drinking and using when I was 9, 10 years old. Can't remember exactly because of drinking and using, but it was somewhere in the fifth grade that I started. And looking back, it's like that I needed to medicate that early in life also helped me work through my own denial and delusion about how the abuse had affected me. Because kids just don't do that normally, unless there's something to medicate. So part of what that brought for me then when life started happening, and I mean, I feel like I've gone through so many different lives in CODA. I don't know about some of you that have been around for a little while, but it's like I keep evolving and changing. And so as I'm evolving and changing, I approach life differently. Definitely when, you know, who I was when CODA first started, one, we were so green, we had no clue of what we were doing, and that was a pretty scary time, actually. As wonderful it was that for CODA to be there, somehow we were supposed to know, you know, be these mature, recovering codependents and know how to run a national conference and know how to run, do all this stuff. And it's like, oh my gosh, I have no clue what I'm doing, you know. And so during that, it was like the support of my other friends that were in recovery were so important to me because I had to continually talk things over. And that was huge. I didn't realize how much communication was part of what I needed in order to feel safe inside. And as many of you, I'm sure, have experienced, I just was not listened to or heard as a kid. And so to have people who genuinely wanted to listen to me and hear and help me process with, again, without there being any shame or judgment or criticism was tremendous. You know, so that was outside of the steps. That was probably one of the biggest things that helped me get through early recovery is I had a really strong support group. I still do, but it was just different back then because we were all kind of like, you know, I felt like we were all like these 10-year-olds sort of holding hands, walking through codependence recovery going, I have no clue what I'm doing, but let's just keep doing it. And in the doing came the answers. I remember hearing that in AA many times. In the doing comes the answers. And in the doing of my codependence recovery came many answers for me and discoveries of who I was. We have gone through so much in the last few years. With my son has been, some of you have heard because I've shared it at many conferences, but my I'm going to try and get through this without crying, but I really don't care if I do. My son passed away from cancer earlier this year in March, and he had been dealing with it for 6 years, in and out of treatment. Through that, this program kept me sane. It was one of the hardest things I've gone through in my life, and am still going through it, still grieving. I'm sure it'll be going on for a while. But if it wasn't for the friends and recovery friends and the people that love me and have loved me through this, I would not get through it. You know, it doesn't mean, I mean, I've been working on this for 35 years. Now, CODA's not that old because we started it in therapy before, of course, CODA was started. But, you know, it's not that life doesn't happen. You know, this happened and just rocked my world. And so dealing with that has been one day at a time, sometimes one moment at a time, you know, and it's been a tremendous exercise in my spirituality with my higher power. I didn't go through this place of being angry with my higher power that my son's name was Shad, that Shad had cancer. I, for whatever reason, trust. I have gained this trust and love with my higher power that I just believe. I don't know how else to say that. So I don't doubt things that happen in my life because I believe my higher power is who gets me through everything, and keeps me in one piece and keeps me evolving and staying in love, instead of scaring myself. It was one of those things during his cancer that I had to deal with, in and out of fear and what was going to happen to him. I always knew it was stage four from the beginning, so I always knew that, you know, the possibility of him passing early was very likely, but always had hope for that miracle. You know, that study that was going to come out, and we all just kind of hung on to that. But we had just a beautiful experience with his passing. And again, that would not have happened if recovery was not there. I would not have been able to be present. I would not have been able to, my daughter-in-law wrote a beautiful song to sing to him while he was passing, and I would not have been able to do those things. You know, I got to spend his last night with him. We didn't know it was going to be his last night, but I was in the hospital with him, and we talked a lot. And there had been so much healing because I was an addict mom for the first 11 years of his life. And then I was kind of a crazy, trying to be in recovery, codependent mom for the next 5 years. So by the time he was almost an adult, I was finally starting to figure things out. But my son had experienced a lot of my dysfunction, and we had worked through a lot with each other. And again, because the program taught me how to do that. It taught me how to show up for myself. It taught me how to be truthful and to be honest and to allow him to have, you know, any feelings that he needed to have and be able to be present for that. I would not have that without this program. And so that has probably been one of the biggest things that I've gone through. But I believe in what codependence recovery does because I absolutely believe that it has to do with who we are and who we are spiritually, who we are within ourselves, and it's about my self-love with myself and not scaring myself anymore. And today is which is so remarkable. I was sharing this with some women I was working with the other day, and that there's a part for me with my, you know, because nobody arrives. Nobody does this perfectly. We're human beings, and so we're always evolving and changing. But, you know, who I am today in my recovery obviously does not even reflect who I was in the beginning of that. And for codependence recovery, I believe that there's greater and greater period in between incident. And then when we get into it, we grab onto our tools faster and get out of it faster. And can do that with love. Instead of scaring ourselves. And so I've noticed with my recovery that because I've had some time, especially with my son's passing, of doing some reflection. I just celebrated 37 years in AA the other day, and so that always brings about some reflection for me as well. But how much my life is different. And how much this disease of codependence just does not rock my world anymore. You know, the grief around my son does. but not the disease around codependence. You know, it's totally different. The relationship I have with Ken is, I mean, we've been together a long time. It'll be 37 years in September when we first started dating, you know. It's like, oh my goodness gracious. And I still like him. Yeah, it really is. I did not see that with my parents. I was married twice before, you know, and so I, once in high school, which is kind of legal going steadying. I don't know if any of you were teenage parents, I was, but my second marriage, I guess, would be more qualified as a marriage since I was actually an adult when I got married. But it, you know, part of what it did for us is it brought about this level of, oh my gosh, just fun and spiritually evolving with each other and getting to know each other, because I am always changing, he's always changing, and we keep showing up for each other in our changes. You know, and so it's not something that ever has been boring, which is just tremendous, you know, because I'm definitely where I came from in my younger years. I was very much a risk taker, so I would get bored easy. But I, even that, I don't do that today. You know, it is something that I'm able to stay put. When Ken and I were first in our early years of our marriage, because I grew up in the same house, stayed in the same house where all the abuse happened. So for me, home was not something that was safe. And so what I would always do is I always want to move. I'd always want to leave. And so many times Ken would come home from work and there'd be a for sale sign in our front yard. And he would walk in and, you know, kind of like, oh, what's happening? And I'd say, well, I think we ought to sell the house and move somewhere else, you know. And that was me in early recovery. I was a runner. And so always wanting to run and change, and, you know, because if I stayed too long in one place, all those feelings would start coming up. And I didn't want to deal with those feelings, and so I wanted to run away from them. That doesn't happen today. It's just something that it's safe for me just to be with me. And to be in my body. My little girl, her name is Mary Lou, and I just love and adore her. Didn't when I first got into recovery. Couldn't even picture her when I first got into recovery. I remember because we started with a therapist, I remember my therapist taking me through a guided imagery. And just, probably many of you know this, but, you know, if you can't picture your child, you're in it. So I could not picture my child for a long time. It took me a while before I matured enough to be able to not be in the child and to start developing this loving self-parent, you know, that is there, that can actually show up for myself. But it's that part of it still continues today. I still look for ways to lovingly self-parent. I like to, in working my steps when I'm doing like my daily maintenance around my recovery, very much prayer and meditation are a huge part of it, because I just believe in that. It helps me stay connected and helps me stay right-sized with myself. You know, letting me and reminding me on a regular basis that my higher power is in charge and I'm not. You know, codependence is a conflict in God's. So we're either going to make ourselves God, or we're going to make somebody else, or a feeling or a situation, or, you know, but we're going to give that power away some way or another, or make it ourselves. And so my prayer and meditation are huge for me. There's always areas where I am able to see my powerlessness, always areas. The difference today is the majority of the time I don't go into the unmanageability around it. And when I do, like I said earlier, I recognize it much faster, so I can do something about it. But I break down my daily maintenance into five areas. So physical, emotional, sexual, spiritual, and intellectual. And I try to stay focused on making sure that I'm loving myself and taking care of myself in those five areas. Because that is what I've been taught is that's what makes us up as a human being. So that's why I try to focus my daily maintenance on that as well. And it keeps me going well. You know, sometimes I get big feelings going on, or, you know, with my son, there's been a lot of different feelings. We've had other stresses in our lives at different times. Throughout our lives, we've gotten hit hard during the financial crisis when that happened and had to deal with all of that, and which was very humbling. You know, so if I have big emotions going on, I growl. I growl, I roar, I do the yoga, you know, lion breath, whatever I need to do to move the energy. I know that my thoughts create my feelings. And so if I don't like how I'm feeling, I need to look at how I'm thinking. And usually that's where, you know, I will take myself back to that and really be able to look at that and see what's going on. My thinking always was created, especially the dysfunctional thinking, was created from all those experiences and all the perceptions and beliefs and everything that I created from my childhood. So when my feelings are such powerful teachers for me. They let me know where I'm at. They let me know if I'm thinking more in my recovery mind, or they let me know if I'm thinking more in that child that's reacting to some trauma. And if I pay attention to my thoughts, then I have the opportunity to intervene on them, change them around, do something different, surrender them to God, growl if I need to. You know, to me, I am willing to do whatever it takes. And so if roaring for me, which some people might seem as a little silly, if it works for me, you know, I'm going to do it because it moves that toxic energy out of my body. And I don't choose to live with that any longer. I still go to, I do both programs, so I still go to AA as well as to CODA. And part of that is I will always be an addict. I have an addict mind. I'm really clear on that. That's that part of that, you know, for sale sign in the front yard. You know, so, you know, and a little bit of that risk taker. But today, instead of doing those kinds of things, what I do if I'm going to be kind of silly, I guess, is I sing and dance around the house. And you can ask, I just, you know, to me, it's just something that's happy and fun inside. And I love doing it. And my little girl loves doing it. So it's one of the ways that I allow some of the playfulness of my child self to come out. That's done in a safe way instead of in a harmful way. I have some friends that I play with that can be very silly with me, and I enjoy doing that. But they're all different pieces. There's so many, you know, when I was thinking about, like, what do I do in maintenance? It's like there's so many different pieces because I've learned so much through the years. The main thing is that I'm willing to show up for myself. You know, I'm willing to show up and be present and to be attentive to myself and to live as conscious of a life as I can. Not that I do it all the time and I make mistakes and all of that. Again, I don't think any of us arrive. You know, my communication is so much better than what it was when I first came into these rooms. Today, I can sit and listen to people, and it's okay if I don't agree with them and they don't agree with me. That's not an issue. I don't need to have anybody agree with me today. And there's some things, views, and you know, whatever that I may have that some of you may like or some may not. And some, you know, when CODA was first started, part of what happened is we were kind of militant codependents. I don't know if any of you relate to that, but it was like we wanted to do it right. You know, so we were, and the intent was good. The intent was there, and that's not in any judgment at all. It's just looking back, you know, I want to go over and just hug all of us that were around at that time, you know, because we were doing the best we could. At that time. And I'm sure, you know, I've heard it in my home group. I'm sure you've heard it at some of your meetings where people will start to get into their codependence with each other. And that's okay. You know, meetings are a great way to learn how to stay in love and stay in communing with each other and stay in recovery. And so, you know, I think they're good practice. In that, and it lets me sit and listen to people and listen to all the different ways that some of you may do your recovery that's different from mine. Because I don't think outside of, you know, I think even in the steps, we're all going to interpret them a little bit differently, you know, because it's how they speak to us. And how the steps speak to me may be a little bit different on how they speak to you. But that is okay. I believe, you know, if I am in a place of surrender with my higher power, that I will hear everything that I need to hear as long as I'm working at my maintenance in my program and staying right size and staying conscious and staying open in my prayer and meditation and living from a place of surrender in my life. So with all of that, you know, I guess if I had something I would want, you know, to, I don't know, like encouragement for all of you would to be to trust yourselves and to love yourselves in the ways that each one of you find the way to love yourself. And to do that without any judgment or analyzing or criticism. Those are always things that kept kind of knocking me off my balance, in a sense. And to stay with this program, it works. It works. It's timeless. You know, we're always evolving and changing. So this one thing about this program that I believe 100% is it's timeless and can be there to serve us throughout our lives. But I thank you so much, and I am so honored that Ken and I were asked to be here, and Jessica, thank you. And thank you to everybody who helped bring food and to put this on and set up the chairs. We got here early watching all of you. I just really appreciate all of you being here because it gives me a place to go, and I am forever grateful for that. Thank you.
So we are on to our next speaker. Please welcome Ken.
Hello, I'm Ken, and I am a grateful recovering codependent. It is just a delight to be here. It's been quite a... No. Is that better? I have a thing about microphones. Anyway, I am just so delighted to be here and to see so many people we haven't seen for a long time, and a lot of new folks. That's why I don't like mics. A lot of new folks. And it's just an honor to be asked to come be here and to share. I was thinking about, you know, Mary was joking about how she loves to sing and dance. Well, she jumped out of bed last night at the hotel and just started singing and dancing to the commercial music on the TV. And I'm going, what are you doing? I'm trying to get sleepy. It's like, okay. She does that a lot, actually. Or, you know, it'll be sitting in the bathroom, and all of a sudden this body is singing and dancing past the door. It's like, what are you doing? Well, I'm just entertaining myself because you're busy. Okay. Anyway, I've really had some time to reflect on maintenance. And for me, maintenance has changed. It's evolved over 35 years. Actually, I just turned 35 and realized that I've been in codependence recovery for half of my life. So that tells you I'm 59 years old, right? That's true. Which is shocking to me. It's like, I want to go, what does that mean? I mean, really, what does that mean? Because it's really about the quality of my life today, this moment, right here, right now, with you. And to me, that's really all there is. An hour ago, a half hour ago has passed. You know, the future's not here. My time with you right here, right now, is the only thing that's real. The only thing that's present. And as I heard a wise person tell me a long time ago, if you want to see the presence of God, just go look in somebody's eyes. And so I see the presence of God in this room is overwhelming to me. And it's a blessing to be here, to be up here and experience all of you from this position. Anybody want to come up and hang out up here and do this too? So it's changed over the years, but it, you know, at first there was no CODA. And when we tried to talk about codependence experiences we were having, because we were in therapy, his, hers, and ours therapy for 2.5 years every week. That probably wasn't enough, because I came from a horrendous background, and Mary, some of you, she shared some of her experience as well, and we didn't do relationships. I had been married, I get a little awkward or uncomfortable to say this, but Mary was my fourth marriage, and I had 3 starter marriages, and I used them to help me prepare for Mary, actually. But I just didn't know how to do it, and my codependence progressed. It was severe in the first marriage with the aid of alcohol and drugs and rage and violence and sexually acting out and emotionally charged all the time, and then running and avoiding and controlling and managing and manipulating and playing small and playing big and being puffy and arrogant and judgmental and critical and shaming. And put, you know, anybody read that column of all the shortcomings in the fourth step that came from my history, as a matter of fact. I was like, oh no, do I have to do this again? And that's what I came from. That's what I grew up with. That's what I saw. That's what I experienced. That's what I knew about how do you relate to, because all codependence really is how do I relate to you? Do I give my power over to you for my well-being? Are you my all? Do you complete me? I'm nothing without you. I'll die without you. And if that's true, then we get to sit down together and write another country western song. I love country western music, to be honest with you, but it's just the most codependent music in the world. My dog died, and I'm living with my horse on the range, and you know, my wife hates me, and I just lost track of where I was. Are we in Louisiana? No. The step work, we had no place to go, and I tried sharing in recovery and other program meetings when I discovered, for example, that I was an incest survivor. And I wanted to share this in a meeting, and you know, my therapist said, well, try it. See what they say. But it was the wrong meeting. Because half the meeting got up and left, and the other half turned sideways, crossed their legs, and put their hands over their crotches. And then my sponsor came up, got right in my face, right? Well, you know, we don't talk about that kind of shit here. This is for recovery and from alcoholism and drugs and blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay. And he was right. He was right. Those programs were designed to help me stay clean and sober. And they did. Thank God. It's been 43 years, which I'm absolutely grateful. And it just gets better. But I can't, they're not designed to help me deal with, for example, toxic shame. You know, or addiction to fear, because codependence at its core emotionally is fundamentally, we know today, a pure addiction to fear. And so many heads are nodding. I'm glad I'm in good company. So So let's all get scared together for a little while. And then we can try the steps and see if it gets us out of it. No. I didn't do fear. I didn't do vulnerable feelings. So I didn't do tears. I didn't do fear. I didn't do pain. I didn't do loneliness. I didn't do guilt, and I didn't do shame. I did one finger, actually, I did. Instead, what do you think that was?
Anger.
Yeah. Any of those other feelings came up, I got angry. I raged. And that's what was modeled to me and my family. That's what I learned. I would twist it around. I'd make it about you. It wasn't about me. When the fact is, I know today that to the degree that I raged, I was also operating from the same amount of fear. Because I felt that small, I had to become that big and puffy to compensate for the amount of fear I was actually feeling. The loneliness in this and the pain behind it. Because shame and fear hurt. If you scare a child, the first thing they do is cry. If you shame a child, same thing, they cry. But as an adult, you shame me, I'm going to be back in your face in a heartbeat, you know. Now, today, I wouldn't do that. I'd probably just say, hey, that was offensive. Please don't talk to me that way. But I had to learn how to do that. I had to learn how to do that in 6 and 7. You know, and so I'll back up. We didn't have any place to go. So we did the steps with our therapist. And thank God this person had been a therapist that I refer. I work in the industry and I have for those 43 years. And I would send my staff. I was a clinical director for a program in Arizona. And I would send my staff members who were having problems to this therapist because she'd been through treatment in our program. And she understood the concepts of multiple addictions and codependence and layered addictions and lateral moves from one to the other to the other to the other. Yeah, I'm clean and sober, but I'm gambling, sexually acting out, and I'm smoking 4 packs a day. But I'm clean. You know, and I'm at that point, I was in a room full of other people who were doing exactly the same thing. So it's like everybody nodded to that, you know. So we worked the steps with this therapist, and I'm so grateful that I had that opportunity because she was actually became one of our first board members and volunteered to be a part of CODA's development as we evolve CODA. And the steps allowed me to. I mean, I'm grateful that I did that with her because if I tried to do that, anybody ever tried to do the steps by yourself? Yeah, some hands going up. It's kind of like doing open heart surgery on yourself. It's like, no. And if I want to know what my higher power is going to say to me, I need to talk to you. I had an old, crusty old sponsor who used to say, you know those old timers in those other programs, you don't have a thing worth saying for the first 6 months, so sit down, shut up, put the cotton out of your mouth, out of your ears and in your mouth, and just listen. Oh, and I wanted to hit this guy so bad. And I'm going, I asked him to be my sponsor? Well, today I am so grateful. You know, he would give me what I needed. I needed to hear those things. And so, you know, he used to tell me, you pray this way, you go to meetings, and invariably you will hear the answer to your prayer in a meeting. And I do to this day. I heard an answer to a prayer, which I'll share with you before I close. It happened this morning at a hotel that we're staying at, and but I'll wait to share that because there's other things I want to share first. And so the steps are the tools. The steps are the program. The steps are what evolve us and change us. They evolve me. They change me. When I work the steps, my life gets better. When I work the steps, I become more humble. When I'm distant from the steps for a long enough period of time, my own ego starts to kick back in. My subtle control mechanisms start to kick back in. I start running the show for myself. I start finding fault with you a little bit. Not a lot. It used to be a lot. Now it's just a little bit. And today, those are symptoms that I need to focus back on what's going on with me. So whether it's a small issue or a large issue, it really boils down for me to the end of the 12th step. And I practice these principles in all my affairs. I don't care what that is, but whatever the next thing is that is troubling me or behaviorally bothering me or that you see that I don't want to see, but you'll tell me if you love me. Today I accept that. At one point I couldn't accept that, but today I want people to be accountable with themselves about how they feel about my behavior. And if that doesn't happen, I'm in serious trouble. Because you're going to let me off the hook, and I'm going to pay a price, and so are other people. And my children did. Shad, Mary had talked about Shad, and Shad was one. Shad was one that I had to talk with and connect with and make amends with, and all of my kids. I have one right now that is troubling me, which means I have a problem. Interestingly enough, if I'm troubled about your behavior, I got a problem. But I want to, as a codependent, I want to make it about you. And if you just change, I sure feel better. So change now. When the fact is, the moment that comes out of my mouth, I got to grab it back and go, wait a minute, I'm the problem. If I'm reacting, I have a problem. It's that simple. Period. And the steps are the way that I get to that. The first three get me right with my higher power. Most of the time. I can convince myself that I'm right with my higher power, but it isn't always necessarily accurate. But I'm better at it today than I've ever been. The next four get me right with my relationship with me. They help me to see my accountability. They help me to see who I am, how I function. Nice. I was just going to say, that's a call from God. Actually, he wants to talk to you. No, I'm just, she does want to talk to you, though. I have no idea. My higher power doesn't have a gender. I think, you know, I want to get off on that so bad, but I'm not going to. I just don't think my higher power has a gender, and I think gender attachment is a human characteristic, and my higher power is far greater than human characteristics. And so, but my higher power sees clearly who and what I am and absolutely loves and adores me. Absolutely loves and adores me. And did when I hated myself with contempt. So maintenance for me is about staying conscious, staying present, staying aware of who I am, being aware of when I'm not right, and how do I reach out to my support system. Someone asked me the other day about, you know, who my friends were, you know, because they were struggling early in their recovery, and they're struggling with whether that a lot of their friends are non-recovering people and they want to go act out. So they're struggling with the transition of letting go of that lifestyle and maintaining a stronger supportive lifestyle. And I didn't encourage him one way or the other than to say, all of my friends are in recovery today. And my friends who aren't, I love and can have conversations, but my conversations with them for the most part are superficial because that's all they will allow. And being the responsible party in my book, I have to be responsible to meet a person where they are. And if I try to get you to change and make you be how I think you should be, I'm back into codependence again. And you become my next best teacher, as my friend used to say. The person you react to next is your next best teacher. I went, yes, no. Because all of a sudden this long line of this list and of all these people in my head triggered me. You know, it's like, okay, here I am. So, and for me today, most of the time I use the word triggers. When I'm emotionally triggered by something, that's my next opportunity to grow. Anybody know that song? Want to sing along? That's my next opportunity to grow. So it's my next opportunity to practice these principles in all my affair. So I would say, if I were really to be honest with myself today, I would say that about roughly 60%, maybe 70% of my time, I am in conscious codependence recovery that has become in some ways unconscious, because it's so automatic now today that I don't think about it. I don't have to think about it. It's just automatic. Instead of judgment, I may immediately go to, God bless that person. You know, especially the guy that just cut me off. Well, those I want to hunt. I used to want to hunt them down and go after them, you know. But today it's like, keep them safe and everybody around them. And I've had all these opportunities over the course of recovery to recognize the ways that I get judgmental, that I get critical, that I get hyper focused, that I give away my sense of power, my sense of grace, my higher power to you. And then if you like me, then I must be okay. And it's that simple. If you like me, then I'm okay. And that goes back to pre-verbal for me. I was aware that I lived in that fear that if you didn't like me, something was wrong, and I was going to get in serious trouble. You were going to be unhappy, and I was going to be punished for that. So some of those play out today. They're wounds that may never go away. We just get better at responding to them, and they have less and less and less power. So it is progressive. I, unlike Mary, I did get angry at my higher power about Chad. And that didn't last very long, but I wanted, he was in remission three times. This was an aggressive cancer that when it came on, it came back aggressively and moved to other parts of his body and eventually took over most of his body over 6 years. But he fought hard. It was always interesting to me that Shad had an amazing spirit, and he knew that part of his recovery process depended upon the quality of his spiritual program or spiritual beliefs, his spirituality, and staying in hope. And I would call him thinking, you know, I'm going to, you know, want to call him, check in. I want to make sure I try to lift him up a little bit, make sure he feels good about how he's going, what's he going. And invariably, by the time I hung up, I felt better. And his spirit had given me hope. And I kept going, wait a minute, I'm supposed to give him up. No, you know, and it took a while to figure that out, that God was working in both our lives. It was amazing. And I gave up the anger at God, you know, because it was like being angry at God isn't going to serve me, isn't going to serve Shad, and it isn't going to serve anybody else for that matter, because this is what is, and I need to come to terms with accepting exactly what is the way it is. But I had fear kicked in right behind the anger, because remember, the anger is giving me power. So the real feeling behind it was the fear that he wouldn't recover, the fear that he was going to suffer, most of all, the fear that he was going to suffer more. And this morning, I had an opportunity. My higher power is very crafty, and I had an opportunity to meet a couple, and at the hotel we're in, and I, you know, asked them where they were from, and they said they were from Hawaii. They're Hawaiian, and we lived in Hawaii for a year. And just the sweetest couple, and probably half my age. And I said, oh, are you here on vacation? And he said, well, I love San Diego. And you know Hawaiians, they love to gamble. So I love to go up to the racetrack. And I said, well, have you been going? Have you won? He said, well, a little. But he said, no, we're really here because our son is in the military. And I went, oh, which branch? And he said, Marines. So he said, and then his wife looked up, and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, but he has stage 4 lymphoma. And I was like, oh. And I was, going, okay, God, what are you doing? You know, and I had this amazing opportunity to spend the next 45 minutes sharing with them my experience, strength, and hope. And they had come to get him out of the barracks because the military kept him on active duty. even though he couldn't function. He'd been through treatment after treatment after treatment. So basically, he would be left in the barracks on a bunk by himself, day by day by day by day. And so finally, they came to get him out of there. And they did. And they were staying at the hotel. And they just wanted to make sure that he got away and, you know, he'd get out from under some of the depression and he could breathe fresh air and whatever. And then we had a chance to talk about what it's like to be parents of someone who is dying from cancer. And to hold their hand and to have some tears come was the most beautiful experience this morning. And I'm going, that's my higher power. It happens all the time. Every single day, there are some or many amazing events that happen that I like to call spiritually synchronistic events. They're perfect planning that I couldn't have planned as well as if I wanted to. Like, how am I going to show up for this couple who's here just fresh off a plane from Hawaii right at this moment before they're going to go into their room to have this conversation with them and to share experience, strength, and hope with them and let them touch my heart and have the opportunity just breathe. I tell people that all the time. Now I get a chance to do it for myself anyway. And then to go upstairs and say, Mary, guess what just happened? And then for us to just one more time hold each other and let the tears come. So I don't know how long the grieving will last, but I'm not going to stop. And I'm so grateful to have a program that allows me to grieve openly. And embrace my feelings and let you experience them and let others experience them and recognize they're more spiritual in nature. Feelings are more spiritual in nature than they are intellectual. Matter of fact, my intellectual mind doesn't understand feelings. I love it when I ask people, how are you feeling? They go, Hold on. I think I'm angry. Some of you relate, don't you? And then they go, I said, so you don't know? No. I think I'm angry. But you don't know. It's because we know that our intellectual mind doesn't understand feeling. It can't tell me how to feel or what I feel. It can make a guess. But if I take a deep breath and breathe into my heart and say, what am I feeling? My heart will tell me in a heartbeat. So I'll often ask somebody to take a deep breath, breathe into your heart. Now tell me, how do you feel? And they come right back congruent. I'm pissed. They go, yes, okay. That's a good connection, you know. And so I used intellect as a way to avoid, control, manage, and manipulate my feelings for a long, long, long time. And I got pretty good at convincing you that I knew what I felt. But I had no idea. So my feelings matter today. That's what makes me human. If I remove feelings from me, I'm just an android. The only way I experience life today is through my feelings. I pay big money to go to movies so I can, as a lot of people at NA say, I go to movies so I can cop a feeling in the dark. Because it's again, you know, you can't do that in the real world out there. They judge the shit out of you for that. And it's like, yeah, I have some really delightful NA friends. These guys are hardline, crusty people that have the biggest hearts in the world. And they don't hesitate to tell me, yeah. And they'll look around like, hopefully nobody's listening. Did you go see that movie about that young boy, blah, 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 blah. And I go, yeah, the one that makes you cry. And he says, yeah, you got to go see it. It's amazing, you know. What he's really saying is, I got to go see a movie, pay $20 so I can see a movie so I can cry in the dark like he did. So the movie industry knows this. They know that we're a repressed society, and we'll pay big money to go have feelings in the dark in a theater. And if we didn't cop a feeling, oh boy, waste of money. That movie sucks. I didn't get the excitement hit I wanted from it, or the anger hit I wanted from the action flick, or the tears from the chick flick, which I don't watch. Mary does, and I'm there to support her. Yeah. That's not true. We were both watching part of a movie today, both of us crying. But that was after we cried about the experience with this lovely family from Hawaii. So this program, I believe I have to keep working it. And my life changes dramatically as I do. It's forced me to change consistently. I am not the person I was a year ago. I'm not the person I was 6 months ago. I don't think I'm even, because of so much change has been taking place, I'm not the person I was a month ago. But I will tell you this, I am so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful to enjoy some time with each of you. I feel at home here, very much so. And I really am honored to be asked to share, and one of the greatest blessings for me is to be heard, and I truly feel heard here today. And I thank you all for being here, and I'm going to close here. So.
I wish to thank our speakers tonight, Ken and Mary. Let's do another. Yeah, we'll just do 10 minutes of some questions. You guys want to come back up?
Because they're recording this, if you wouldn't mind coming up to use the microphone to ask the question, that way they will be able to capture that as well. Tricky. I'm recording.
I had a question for both of you. When you have a trigger, you called it a trigger, I don't know what you called it, Mary. How do you deal with that when you're aware, or, I mean, obviously you're so far in your recovery, you're probably aware of the trigger. How would you describe it to someone who may not be as seasoned as you guys? What do you do when you feel like you're in a trigger?
What I do is, usually when I'm triggered about something, I'm basically emotionally reacting. Okay, so I'm angry, or I'm scared, or I've shut down, I've gotten small, or I've gotten big and puffy, or, you know, behaviorally I go to codependent protection. That's a symptom. So I need to back up as fast as possible from the circumstance and just say, I need to be accountable. If, for example, if someone understands it and they say, well, I just want to let you know I'm triggered right now, so I want to talk about this, but I'm going to take a break because I need to figure this out. To me, triggers are my higher power's way of getting my attention. They show me that I'm not finished yet, and that some part of my history is active right now, in the here and now, and they're not going to go away. Some of my triggers have continued to come again and again and again and again, and they're going to keep coming until I have an opportunity to deal with it head on. And most of them I don't like, so what I do is I'll pray first, always, as a good friend told me many, many years ago, if you're going to deal with something, make sure you get the power greater than you in the room with you right here, right now first, because the outcome will be far different than if you didn't. And I tried that, and sure enough, it was. So I pray first. Next thing I do is I write. Who, what, when, where, and how does this remind me of from my past?
Can you repeat?
No. I love being a brat. Some of you can tell that. But I learned from Mary.
You what?
Being a brat. I learned from Mary.
We can know the truth.
Who, what, when, where, and how does this remind me of from my past? And what I found interesting over the years is that what I usually get triggered about are small things. A glance, a sigh. And, well, what does that mean? But my emotional reaction is this big. So anything beyond what would be a normal response to a situation is always about my history. And so God's trying to get my attention and show me I have an opportunity right now to deal with this. And actually, one was a glance. My mom, I was glance trained. Many of you relate to that. I mean, a room this size, this many people, she could be back over there. You could all be standing. She could kind of get right between two people, get my attention. And that glare meant, holy crap. It meant bad things were going to happen. That fly just loves me.
I can see it. It's just hanging around you.
I love you too. Go away now. Or I'm going to kill you. I mean it. And so, but the emotional reaction would be this big. And that's the trigger. That's the opportunity to deal with what this emotional reaction is all about. Her turn. So once I can write about who, what, when, where, and how does this remind me of, sometimes I may not get the insight and the connection between the, I can't connect the dots yet between the here and now and what it was about from my past. Okay. Irregardless, I still have the emotional energy charged in my body. And if I don't deal with that emotional energy, it's going to come out here, or my kids, or my grandkids. So my job then is to go do the types of things that Mary described as power work, emotional release work. I need to flush this out of my body. We know that it takes anywhere from 30 to 35 minutes to normalize and calm the nervous system of an emotional charge if we don't think about the situation anymore. Try being triggered and not think about it for 35 minutes. Oh, that's a fan. You know, it does, for me, it always comes back. And so I had to learn, because I was a rager, I had to learn how to make anger my friend, and I had to learn how to do emotional power work and release emotional energy in healthy ways. And we've been teaching outside of this environment. We've been teaching that for years, although we've had whole conferences stand up and growl with us. It's really kind of fun. But on this side, when you're coming, when it's coming, it's intense. So let me go behind you if you ever want to do it. Yeah. But move that emotional energy, and all we're doing is flushing the emotional toilet, because it's the nervous system that carries it. So once I've done that, then I would look clearly, because I'm not triggered and I'm not charged. Then I look at Mary and I may say, do I need to say anything to her? And at least 50% of the time or more, not a thing. Not a thing. All she did was sigh. That was it, or glare, or glance, you know, but she did it sight, kind of like this, or so, is she mad? You know, I got little. But I don't do little, so I cover it up and make it sound clinical and therapeutic, which has been a downfall for me. The other 50% of the time, I can see clearly what it is I emotionally reacted to, and I can come back cleanly and clearly and say, I felt, and I'd like to ask you if you would do this instead. Now we can have a clean conversation, and it's not emotionally charged. I'm not coming out the side of my neck with a little bit of something, but I'm using the words right, but the energy is like I'm gonna blow you away. It's just a clean, clear conversation. So always pray, write about it, and do emotional release work. It works. Uh-huh. I mean, being a recovering rager, I don't rage. And it's that in its own right is miraculous, because that's all I did. I got thrown out of 7 schools because I raged. There were very few that I was ever going to go to after that. So, that answer your question? Okay.
Somebody back here.
Oh.
Was there a question over here? Oh, okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
Ken said something that prayer was answered. What was the prayer that was answered?
Oh, I'm sorry. There was somebody. Welcome.
So I'm kind of new to recovery, and so I was kind of presenting a question, which is like, how does one go about hoping when they tend to feel that they're powerless over their emotions? And, you know, the first step is powerless over others, but others influence my emotions. So it's like, how does one hope when I gauge everything on my emotions and I'm powerless over my emotions? Thanks.
It's a good question.
It is a good question.
Yeah.
So part of,
and just sharing from myself with that is usually my, you know, Kim was talking a little bit about this, but my reactions to something that somebody else does has to do that with something within me that is still not healed yet. So when those emotions, for me, I kind of gauge them. If they're over a 3 or 4 on a 10-point scale of intensity, that's where I've kind of got 1 foot in yesterday and 1 foot in today. So I do what Kim was talking about. I will take a break and, you know, get into that place. I'll start doing some breathing, some journaling, call somebody to be able to get right within myself if my emotions are charged, so that I can then get right sized. I may still have emotions about like something that somebody said or did, but I'm not going to be reactive to them. When I'm reactive, that to me is my powerlessness and unmanageability in action. When that reaction is there, when I can be more what I call responsive, then I'm going to be able to have emotional intimacy with you at those times. Does that help? Okay, thank you.
Just one comment. When we struggled with the issue when we first started CODA with especially the steps as to how we should formulate the first step. And it was voted on by the brand new board of trustees we developed to keep it others, because usually that's our problem at first. We recognize my problems with you, and you just changed. I'd be okay. Well, you know. but we also knew that the real issue is I'm powerless over me, or I'm powerless over my feelings. They're bigger than I am, and I can't control them. So I'm out of control. I'm powerless over... I've been powerless over everything at one point or another. You know, and so we can... All we have to do is fill in the blank in that first step and then walk through the rest of the steps. And the steps will walk us through every problem there is. There's not a problem I've come up against yet that I've been able to... that I haven't been able to use the steps on to resolve. I may need additional information... but the steps always bring me back to center. Yeah.
There was just one question over here real quick. No. Go ahead. There was a question for you.
My question was, uh-huh. You said that you had answered prayers. You didn't say what was answered.
I did say that. Now I'm blank on what I was talking about.
It was the story around the couple that you met today. That was an answer to a prayer.
Oh, the interesting, because I mentioned this to Mary 3 times between the time we got in the car and got up this morning. At one point, there's this thing that happens to me every once in a while, and my brain just goes blank. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. What am I going to say? I even said, what are you going to say? Can I piggyback on what you're going to say? You know, it's like, I didn't know what that was. And then I had this experience with this couple, and it opened my heart up like a can opener at the moment. And that was my prayer. That was my answer to prayer. So these people showed up, and part of it was to help answer my prayer, plus the opportunity to share with them what God has done for me through this process and did for Mary, and was I could see was doing for his wife and for him, and how amazing it was they came and rescued him out of that barracks yesterday. Yeah, so thanks for asking. Yeah.
Frank?
Some of us here have had over the past 10 years the privilege of going to the Women's Detention and Reentry Facility in Las Colinas. And most of the women that we run into, many of them at least, are really have extremely traumatic childhoods, and most definitely probably suffer from PTS. And I know the two of you have had a lot to do with that. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that that maybe we could bring to our program there.
So let me just clarify, are you wondering, you know, what information you could bring to them, or
All I know is that I think I know that you've had some experience with the kind of things we're dealing with. You might have some insights that we don't have.
Yeah. So I'm assuming you're probably talking about that many of the women have gone through abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse in that. One of the things that was real, that was helpful, you know, in as part of my recovery work was to, one is to get, like get journal books to where, like, my dad was my main perpetrator, and so get a journal book that I was doing to writing to my father about the sexual abuse, because it went on for a number of years in my childhood, and I kept writing on that until I was done. You know, and during that, I would also still talk with people about it. I still worked my steps around it, did power work around it. But it was a way for me when, because it wasn't safe for me to have feelings as a child, it was hard then for me, and I'm a bit of an introvert, to be able to talk to somebody and be in feelings at the same time. For a number of years, that was hard for me. And so having a place where I could write it kind of privately and let my feelings come helped a lot to move through it. And bottom line, to know it wasn't about me. You know, when we're, you know, below the ages of 18, 19, it is not about us. It is about the, it is the adult's responsibility, whoever it is that's perpetrating, whatever it is that's going on. The other thing that helped a lot was my working on my self-talk. And so I'm, anybody that I sponsor, I am huge in affirmations. Because I had this whole committee up here that was connected to the toxic shame that were messages that what I've come to learn is not one of them were true. If it's a toxic shame message, it's a lie. Just plain and simple. And so I had to, I went through a whole process of, in those five areas I was sharing about earlier, the physical, emotional, sexual, spiritual, and intellectual, I went through and wrote down all the negative messages, fear messages, shame messages, critical, judgmental that I had about myself that I learned or that I told myself. It didn't really matter. And then I would go through and create a truthful, what I believed was a God-centered affirmation for each one of those. And then I took those and I recorded them in my own voice and I started listening to them a couple times a day. And it took, for me, it took on that about 9 months before I really started hearing them without listening to them and disassociating. Because I disassociated a lot because that's how I survived my abuse. And so what would happen is if I started listening to something that was contrary to what I was taught about myself, I would start to zone out. I'd start to disassociate because I wasn't supposed to believe that. I knew how to do life through fear, shame, you know, all of that. I didn't know how to do life through love and being loving towards myself. So I don't know if that helps. Those were just some pieces that, that stood out for me and when I was doing my trauma work. A lot of the women I've talked with in recovery, and I'm professional, so women I've worked with, I would guess most of the women that are in jail system or prison have gotten their out of codependence. The majority, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing there.
I wanted to add one piece to that. Would be that the first step tells us how we got here. Most of us, those of us who are in other 12-step programs, we've been telling the teenager story in those programs forever. Yeah. When we picked up, how old we were, what happened, how it progressed, how life got screwed up, how I became unmanageable and my life fell apart and then I hit a bottom and I got clean. So we've never told the story, what happened that got me to pick up the first time or what happened that got these women into prison. you know, what came up for them. And so writing, I really am a firm believer in writing a first step to write my story up to about 18 years old. What happened to me emotionally, physically, sexually, intellectually, and spiritually, and to include the four major areas of abuse. So emotional abuse, abandonment, enmeshment, neglect. Physical abuse, abandonment, enmeshment, neglect. Sexual abuse, abandonment, enmeshment, neglect. When I'm done with that story, I saw clearly how I got here and why I was so messed up. And why I picked up and used drugs and why I had 4 months to live at 28 years old. And why the doctor said, you got 4 months to live, and if you don't stop using, you're going to die. And I went, I don't care if it was good enough for my father at 42, it's good enough for me. F him. Obviously, I'm still here, so I I got clean. But yeah, but it's helpful for that. It shows us how we got here, and we can start to develop compassion for what happened to us. You know, I was mistreated, and I could be compassionate about that instead of going, what's wrong with me? God, I'm a stupid idiot, and then beat myself up. That's helpful. Fourth step then says, out of what everything happened to me, what have I become? How have I become big, small, offensive, abusive, judgmental, critical, shaming, or nice? I could say that here. Mary would get mad at me when I would say, you are so nice. I hate that word. I want to be mean and ugly. Because she was so nice. Anyway, there was a question.
Not quite mean and ugly, but...
Yes.
I know for me, the biggest component for recovery continues to be what I call resurrection of my inner child, because I didn't feel alive growing up. I mean, it was a robot. Can you talk a little bit about how you got in touch with your inner children, and children meaning all parts, but also how what do you recommend, especially with a lot of us that have that frozen feeling syndrome?
Okay.
I shared a little bit during the first time that I got my therapist at that time, because Coda wasn't around, but had done an inner child imagery, and I couldn't see her at all because I was in my child. When I started being able to see those parts of me, they were actually attached to the ages that I felt when I was in reaction. And so somebody started asking me the question that was very helpful. So when I'm in reaction early on, they said, how old does that feel? Simple question. I could identify the age every single time. And so it was various ages. And so I got out pictures of myself. I wrote to myself. I talked to my little girl. I had a stuffed animal. I did anything that was recommended out there that I could do to connect with those parts of myself and to begin to love and kind of grow myself back up. But it was, I wasn't so much frozen in it for myself. I was just in it. I was just, yeah. I don't know.
My first experience was with this was before inner child work was considered mainstream. As a matter of fact, my therapist asked me that question, and he was trying to get me beyond my defense mechanisms and into some pain. And so he asked me two questions. He basically said, when you see pain, what do you see? And immediately I saw this big, black, horrible pit that if I get into that, I will never come out. I was convinced it was that much, and I wouldn't deal with it. And he said, how old do you feel? And I said, about 6 or 7 years old. And so he was a Gestalt therapist. Those of you who understand how Gestalt works, well, he said, well, let's bring him in here. Set him right there. And I'm going, okay, I see him. And he said, what do you want to say to him? I don't know. I mean, I didn't have any idea. I didn't know him or connect. I just knew I didn't like him. And I've been trying to kill him. And he carried all that was bad about me. And so all the shame messages, the toxic stuff, the ugliness, the pain, the hurt, the anger, the rage, you know, he'd been raging since he was 4 years old. And I hated him, and I hated the name my family gave him. My middle name is T. I have a middle initial. And I'm Junior. So they called me Tim to tell between my dad and I. And so his name was Tim, and my sisters were Timmy. Oh, I used to hate them when they do that. And I hated this kid, and I said, I hate him. And I looked over at him, and tears were pouring down his face. And I said, he's got all that pain. So he said, like most Gestalt therapists do, take a deep breath, breathe out of who's sitting here, and go over and sit into him. So I did. I went over and I sat into him, and the pain came. And he said, close your eyes. Do you trust me? And that was my downfall. He said, I'll tie a lot of Gestalt work is imagery. He said, I'll tie a rope around your waist. I'll lower you into that pit, and I promise I will pull you back out anytime you want me to. Okay, so I went in, and I mean, huge amount of pain came for about 10 minutes, and all of a sudden it was done, and it passed. And I was like, there's no more? I was shocked that I could actually have those kinds of tears for that length of time, and that I still felt like that little boy, but I didn't hate him. I really liked him. That he was, I got it, that he was my spontaneity and my creativity and my play and my fun and my laughter and my hopes and my dreams and my delight. And the part of me that has the most fun with this little girl over here when she's dancing around the bed before she goes to sleep. But, and those of you who have allowed that child to come out in a relationship know exactly what I'm talking about. That's what we want. That's where the most beautiful spiritual part of who I am is, other than my higher self. My spirit lives in that child. So I had to develop a relationship with him. And then as time went by, and I went to work at the Meadows and I became their clinical director, we started to integrate that work into the mainstream treatment process. And then a lot of other people that you've all read about or read their work has evolved out of that. And so we were all babies trying to figure this stuff out. We were like teenagers trying to figure out, what is this codependent thing? And how do you deal with it? And we just didn't know. And so loving, I love him more today than I've ever loved him. And sometimes I scratch my head and I go, why would I have ever wanted to try to hurt this little guy? He's the sweetest thing in the world. You know, he's and my parent, if you look at, you know, there's a theories, there's a child, parent, adult, and higher self. Well, my parent's job is to protect him. My adult is for me to interact with you. My higher self is how to connect with what lays beyond here. Well, that just leaves that little boy. And everything is to support him. And so there's a part of this little boy that comes up here and goes, oh, we get to play with the microphone, we get to make jokes, we get to have fun, you know. And then I got to back him down just a little bit, because some people go, are you the founder? Well, no, we are. And we've had people look at us, by the way. We've been in airports, and people they hold a sign, Ken and Mary Richardson, they're looking for us, and we walk out and stand right in front of them, and they're looking around us. And they go, we're Ken and Mary, and they go, well, this was back in the day. You're too young. Because we were like in, you know, 35 years ago. So I was 35, and you were younger than that. So they thought we were too young to be founders. So I guess we finally caught up with ourselves.
Now we're old and wise and look the part.
Don't give them that impression. We'll have to live up to it.
We've gone over our 10 minutes, but yeah. Thank you so much for
Thank
everybody.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you again. Thank you. Yeah.